And some of them were even inspired by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, and that inspiration caused them to actually get involved in the journalism business or even become a journalist, just to speak about this great leader and to walk the path of that great leader, and also
to be able to resist
in that manner, in the words, not because that's the only language that they know, and they wanted to be part of this of this ideology, and this is the only way that they can be. So he played a very important role in being an inspiration even to these journalists. According to agencies, they highlighted or estimated the number of attendees more than 1.5 million yesterday. Was it expected?
Well, we were discussing it the day before, along with foreign media and local media as well, and some people were estimating it's not going to be more than a few hundred thousands because of the cold weather, because of the threats, etc. And some others were saying, well, we bet it's going to cross 1 million. Mm-hmm. Our primary estimates before we lost any connection, because when once we went into the media, to the sports city, I keep calling it media city because it's of the media office outside, but the moment we got in, we got cut off from the world because of the type of pressure that you have, like hundreds of thousands of mobile phones using signal at the same time, and then the jamming for the positions. So our estimates, the primary estimates, were 800,000 by midday. After that, people continued to flood from Bekaa area. We know that over 250,000 people came down from Bekaa area. So we easily crossed the 1 million by, let's say, 2 p.m. And then the funeral procession, where people were walking and they were covering all the highway from both ends, from end to end and from one side to the other, it was I mean, like, definitely above 1 million.
And all the area here was secured around the stadium. However, people chose to come early morning yesterday, at dawn, even before that, at night, people, just to find places in the stadium
there were
to be close to the grave.
Yes. There were some people who set up tents in nearby areas because they came down from south and from the Bekaa. Some people slept in their cars.
Yes.
They just booked the first seat in, as you call them. By the time we made it to the stadium, around 10:30, most of the seats in the stadium were already filled.
Yes.
The outside squares were almost filled, and the outside squares fill up to 40,000 people. The field in the stadium fills up to 20,000. That was completely, by 12 noon, it was completely done. Then you had, like, the what you call official delegations, like the 3-4 people coming from every country. Mm-hmm. That's different.
And the seats were booked.
And the seats, you have about 55,000 seats inside the stadium. Mm-hmm. Just the chairs alone, they were full. And then people started sitting in between the seats, like on the stairs. So I do estimate, like, inside the media city and the squares, it was around 120,000 minimum.
Okay.
The sports city again. I'm sorry about that.
Yes, Shakamil Shamoun sports venue. Okay, taking into consideration that there were a lot of restrictions before that, and that's why the number is kind of astonishing, because with all the restrictions that were happening, some analyzed that there wouldn't be a lot of mass, or we wouldn't find a large number of people attending. As we were highlighting previously, due to the rise in the prices of the hotels surrounding Kamil Shamoun area, and also due to the rise in the tickets, especially those that want to come to Beirut.
Plane tickets, be other people thinking that Hezbollah is selling tickets for entry for the sports city. No, plane tickets, you mean plane tickets.
Yes, of course, plane tickets, because there were a lot of foreigners coming to Lebanon just for this cause. And for sure they had to pay double the prices to come to Beirut. And even some local and domestic local politicians, they were criticizing the location that the funeral procession will take place. And they say, why this place? Do it in another area. Certain kind of restrictions were actually applied, but yet that did not stop the people or the participants to attend the funeral procession. And taking into consideration also the weather, it was very cold yesterday.
But it was sunny.
Yes, in the daytime it was sunny, but the day before it was really cold, and throughout the day we had the moments where it was really freezing, but yet people kept that aside and wanted to come for that cause. Why, in your opinion, what is significant about Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah that everything is being neglected, and even if they want to, and even I heard someone saying, even if I need to come crawling, I will.
He was not only an inspirational man, he is imprinted in people's hearts and minds. They've known no one to lead the resistance but him for 32 years. It's really hard to actually imagine life without him, and they owe him a lot. Most of the southerners, most of people in South Lebanon, for example, they owe him that in 2000 they were able to see their villages for the first time. They grew up away from their villages. The Israelis had occupied most of these southern Lebanese villages, and nobody was allowed back. Mm-hmm. And for the first time in the year 2000, 8 years after he became Secretary General for Hezbollah in 1992, they were able to go back. And this is imprinted in their minds. In 2006, it's also imprinted in their minds that he is the leader who actually beat the invincible army, supposedly, in the Middle East. And for 34 days, the Israelis couldn't do anything to fight the resistance or stop them from launching missiles. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, despite the destruction that we've seen this time and the brutality and the monstrosity of the Israeli occupation, he was the only one saying no, and he was standing with a just cause, which is the Palestinian cause. Mm-hmm. Not a single Arab leader did action with words, combined actions with words. He was the only one who would, when he promised, he would deliver. Others, they would just talk that they're supporting a certain cause or that they like the Lebanese, they like the Palestinians, but there's no action at all. Mm-hmm. So it's respect, love, getting used to only one leader that they don't know anybody else aside from him, and at the same time, he's their idol. Yes. Are you going to basically separate such people from him? He's from the people. He's a resistance. They are a resistance. Resistance goes together.
Okay, and on several occasions, he expressed that love that he has to the people of the resistance. And one of the speeches that I heard yesterday, he said that when I see you, I give you energy. And when you see me, I take the energy back from you, just the same way that you're comfortable. Of course, here he was conducting this whole speech to the people of the resistance in one of the occasions, and making it clear to them that it's not only you that you're happy with me around, I am also happy when I see you, because I take all the power that I need from the people. However, Leila, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, if you want to look at it from a different dimension, he has a special connection with everyone. It's like everyone feels that he lost a father, his own father. It's not just a leader. Someone very dear and someone very close to them. The 14-year-old, the 13-year-old, the 10-year-old child, the elderly, the women, men. We're working in different fields. They all feel connected. How did Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah manage to actually reach to the hearts of all these people at the same time?
Well, it's very easy. He was genuine. I had the honor of meeting him before.
Personally.
And I sat down on July 12, 2006 was the last time I saw him face to face. And that was the day that he actually held the press conference to speak about the two Israeli prisoners of war that they took. And I had asked him a question, and he laughed because my Arabic
What's the question that you asked?
My Arabic was broken. I actually asked him two questions in one. The first question was basically, were you contacted by any entity to facilitate negotiations to release the two Israeli prisoners of war?
Yeah, that's a good question.
And the second question was that, well, over the past few months, you tried to detain Israeli soldiers, and it failed, like two previous attempts. Mm-hmm. Don't you think that the Israelis are sending you eight soldiers to the same location, and they're lightly armed? Don't you think it's a setup? They weren't having a picnic, and the word I used is kazdura in Arabic.
Yes.
And he looked at me, and he you could see his teeth when he was laughing. He was happy, but then he controlled himself.
Yes.
And then he's like, no, it was a hard work. We were monitoring it for the longest time, and thank God, basically, it was successful.
What did it feel like, you being in his presence?
You know, it's
him being in your presence.
You know when you feel lighthearted and you go out and you don't remember anything from what happened inside, and like years down the line you start remembering all the details? Mm-hmm. You forget anything when he's there. You're just looking at him and he's so genuine, and he's like, you feel at ease. This is the first thing that you feel. Like, it's not like you're afraid of him or anything else. He has this aura where you're comfortable, but you know that you're in the presence of a great man. And because he's genuine and he asks you certain things, and then we're looking at him, he is concerned, he wants to know, right? And I think this is the connection between him and the people. People believe that he's genuine, they feel that he's genuine, not only from his words, but also from his features. You cannot hide it forever. If he doesn't like something, it shows on him. If he likes something, it shows on him. Mm-hmm. And when he's sad, everybody is sad around him. You get to feel it. You get to feel it. Yeah.
Yes. Of course, knowing this information will actually allow us to understand more why people that haven't met him, even those that did not see him, they still have the same impression as you're highlighting. It's due to the actions, not only his own presence. However, the word that we always hear from the people that we actually interview, what is like the most significant aspect that you love about Sayyid Hassan? The first answer is, Sayyid Hassan boosts my morale.
He makes you
feel this has a
invincible.
Lot of connotations. I mean, whenever you're sad, whenever you're depressed, whenever you feel angry, whenever you have that clear vision or clear image of how to read politics, of how to read the political developments in the area, then this man comes in, or this leader comes in, to give you a clear agenda of what has happened, what is happening, and what is expected to happen. Do you agree with that?
I do. I mean, the thing is, at the end of the day, there are certain people who are born with a special connection to everyone, and it's really
what
hard
is that,
to replicate
a charisma?
Them. Well, the whole thing in itself is aura and charisma, mm-hmm. and not everybody has it. You can be a great leader, but minus that charisma, people don't connect to you. It will be just like basically a school teacher dictating them something. With him, it's the he truly believed in what he was saying, and that's why you can actually believe what he says. At the same time, I don't know how to describe it. It's out of this. It's really hard to replicate him. It's really hard. I mean, he left some big shoes to fill, not only by whoever basically came after him, like Sheikh Naim Qasim, among others. And remember, they came together and they stayed together for a long time. But for all the leaders across the world, it's really rare to see this kind of specimen in leadership where he is close to the people. People love him, even when he's behind a screen. Mm-hmm. Like, there are certain times when he never appeared in front of people again. But people would still wait for him to appear on TV to listen
after
to that, to get the positive energy,
yes.
to hear what he has to say. And because he was truthful, he never lied to his people. And this is very important. Even the Israelis, by the way, the Israeli public, I'm not talking about the Israeli media or basically the government, but the Israeli public used to wait for his speeches to make sure that their government is not lying to them.
Mm-hmm.
So his truthfulness is actually what also attracted people. And it added to not only his credible image, but it also added to his assertive manner that when he promises you something, it will happen.
And the most astonishing part is that there are no certain people that loves him.
Yeah.
However, everyone loves him. Coming from different sects, from different religions, from different ethics, from different morals. For example, also we actually heard the story of a man who was standing and he was screaming yesterday, saying that I am not a good person. I commit a lot of mistakes in my life, and I am not following the Islamic rituals or applying it the way that it should be applied. However, I love Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, and that by itself you cannot judge me on. I have the right to choose whoever I love, even if I'm not a saint.
Well, he didn't judge people. He mm-hmm. judged actions, mm-hmm. but at the end of the day, he's somebody that you would feel he's forgiving.
Yes.
No matter what.
And we've seen people from different sects, Christians.
You would see it from the
Jews,
resistance.
Yes.
Forget anything.
They are all
you'd
coming
see it from
in.
The resistance way of fighting. They always act ethically. They fight ethically. They don't target women and children. They don't target houses of worship. They don't target civilian areas. And the only time they targeted civilian areas is when the Israeli occupation forces were in those areas, taking them as barracks, right? And they took their own people as hostages, by the way.
Yes.
This is the Israeli occupation. So at the end of the day, when you have that resistance consistently fighting ethically, you know that they are being led by an ethical leader,
mm-hmm.
no matter what.
Yes. But do you think that openness among the people is the result of Hezbollah's involvement in the Palestinian cause? Because people can look at it from this dimension, that the Shias actually protected the Sunnis. So therefore, this group is open-minded and is open to all sects and do not differentiate. Rather, they deal with us as a human and not to what religion we belong to or what ethics and morals we believe in or whatever facts we have in our lives. So do you think that added up to this openness that we've seen yesterday? We've seen people coming from Europe, from Brazil,
we saw
from Algeria.
Jews and Christians.
Jews,
attending.
Christians, exactly. So do you think that this political involvement in the region allowed them to understand more about Sayyid Hassan?
It's not just the political involvement in the region. You have to understand one thing. They've been subject to
Israel. They felt comfortable.
But they've been subject for the longest time. They were subjected to a mass propaganda campaign against Hezbollah to tarnish its image since 2006 until today. Mm-hmm. And the Americans actually confessed. Jeffrey Feltman, the former U.S. ambassador to Lebanon, said, we've put in about $500 million to tarnish Hezbollah's image. And that image had brought into people's minds, it's Shia versus pitted versus Sunnis. Mm-hmm. Nobody likes each other. It's a very, very dangerous place. And the Muslims are out to kill everybody. The Shia, they don't like anyone. And then suddenly
because they're trying to incite sectarianism.
And suddenly you see basically Hezbollah, which is mostly Shia dominated, because they do have Sunnis fighting with them and they have Christians fighting with them. By the way, mm-hmm. this is something that most people don't know. Mm-hmm. Standing next to the Palestinian cause, and some people were trying to portray it as an Islamic cause, and as a Sunni cause, mm-hmm. Sayyid Hassan made sure to tell everybody, it's not only a Muslim cause mm-hmm. or an Arab cause, it's a humane cause, like
yes.
it's about humanity. Mm-hmm. And this is what broke the tarnished image in the mindset of a lot of people, including officials who some of them came to this
funeral. Is it clear to the enemies that this paper is burned by now, the sectarian paper? Is it? Do you think that they actually reached to that? Because they're playing on another card
right now.
It's
totally burned, and they're trying to do something else. They're carrying out with their what you call propaganda and smear campaign mm-hmm. and character assassination, mm-hmm. as you call it. But at the end of the day, people now know their ways. The thing is they've taken to social media to try to spread that everybody hates everybody. Mm-hmm. But in the fact, it's two groups of the same Israeli entity and the Americans and those who are helping them, just bickering among each other to insinuate that there is a bickering among the mass public.
Okay. One of the most significant scenes was the well-organized procession yesterday. This is an organization, a resistance group that has been out of massive war, demolished their homes, made them lose dear ones. They are broken. Their leader, top rank leaders, have been assassinated. Very sad from inside for what happened to his own country, but yet managed to actually organize a grand funeral procession, a grand funeral ceremony with this specific. We've seen what happened yesterday. Everything was managed in a perfect manner.
To the T, I would say.
Exactly. And in no time, only a few months preparations. Of course, here, if you may allow me, I have a lot of information. For example, to ensure the safety of the attendees, the Islamic Health Society has deployed 1,500 medical volunteers yesterday, including paramedics, doctors, and nurses, across 60 medical tents. Additionally, 100 ambulances have been stationed along the funeral route. In addition to how it was programmed, in addition to how everything was managed in a perfect way, of course, taking into consideration that we had an estimate of 1.5 million participants yesterday, but still everything was managed in a perfect condition, in a perfect way. How do you view this?
I found it as a supernatural, not like human, like superhuman. Kind
but
of
so
work.
What happened yesterday needs a huge government
it's
to actually organize.
It needs a massive security apparatus just to be able to contain and maintain the people, because any infiltrator could cause harm, mm-hmm. be it through a blast or creating problems on the ground, etc. But I'll say something that's based on experience. It happened to us as reporters. You remember that the media office received a massive blow when the Israeli occupation forces assassinated Haji Muhammad Afif Nablusi, who was the head of the media office for Hezbollah, along with several crew members, four of them. Mm-hmm. And so they lost a significant part of those who work as an organization, on an organizational capacity mm-hmm. and on strategy capacity.
Yes.
Yet the media office was able to pull everything together, all the strings together, despite some discrepancies, and it wasn't their fault. And I was saying that basically I went down to the hotel to pick up my card for the funeral procession so we can enter the sports city, not media city this time.
Yes.
But there were hundreds of reporters who did not register online. They should have registered 2 months ago when they opened the door and they alerted everyone.
Okay.
They didn't register. They made a walk-in in the morning demanding cards. And some of them were, they had their cameras prepared and they started taking photos and they posted like, oh, it's not organized.
Okay.
The ones who were registered received their tickets. They're basically what you call the
order.
The press card, mm-hmm. because it's not only per order. There's a security element. They have to check your background. You have to present your picture and your data and your data.
For
background.
Safety reasons.
If you come as a walk-in last minute to such a massive event, And they know anything about you. And
most will not allow you in.
Most of them were foreigners. They were not Lebanese, mind you.
Yes.
So I don't know if you're a criminal. Maybe you're a Mossad. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that my colleagues are like that. But just in case, you have to understand the security aspect. And still, they cater to people. They told them to stand in line, and they gave them numbers.
Okay.
What did they do? They all heard, like, just like a large herd just jumped together. They demanded the cards now. It's like, you can't get a press card unless you stand in line and wait for your number to be called in, and they will look into your details. They will give you that.
Okay.
So that pressure was, I do believe it was done on purpose so they can publish that kind of news. And the other media who had their cards, they just dismissed it directly. It's like, no, it was organized. We had registered before, and that's it.
Mm-hmm. Our time is almost getting to an end. Leila, in one word, of course, after what happened yesterday, after the funeral procession ended, and this morning also people are still grieving. But however, how do you see what happened yesterday will reflect on the political situation or on the political stance of Hezbollah and the government?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. The government will think twice before vexing that kind of constituency. Remember, they also had Christians from other areas coming over mm-hmm. to support, to show support to Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah
yes.
and the resistance itself. And people were crying among them. Like, I have lots of friends among them who were crying. But you have to think about it from a different perspective. We're also approaching the parliamentary elections.
So they will think twice. Yes, exactly. Yes.
Next year we'll have the parliamentary elections, mm-hmm. right? And this tells the other constituents, the other political parties, if you don't unite with us or collaborate with us, you will be losing those votes.
Yes.
You have collaborated with us in the past and you received our votes. That's why you are members of the parliament now. But if you work against us, the best thing we have is like put our votes where they actually, people who merit them, and we will have new allies.
Yes.
And this will make them think twice of how okay. they deal with Hezbollah.
Leila Hatoum, Editor-in-Chief, MENA Uncensored, thank you very much for joining us in this conversation. Thank you very much.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Please stay tuned. If in a faithful community like ours, that is Islamic Republic of Iran, believers were close to each other, they will strengthen their sacred bonds. In the face of the plan of Satan, who wants to isolate people, distance them from each other, and create hatred and grudges, believers preserved and showed mercy to each other and felt a sense of responsibility towards each other, then a collective spirit prevails over there. individualism and egotism decrease. This is a sign of the growth of believers who see the collective interest. This community is ready to accept the social guardianship of the guardian of Allah. It is ready for the guardian of Allah to come. This is a very important point, which is why God, in Ayah 200 of Surah Ali Imran, has made individual patience and collective perseverance a prerequisite for the emergence for the social guardianship of the Imam of the time, Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIVE English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program and our other programs, please visit our website at iranradio.ir. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Muscle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The global stock markets have become jittery with Donald Trump pushing for steep tariffs on Canadian, Chinese and Mexican products. We take a look at the economic repercussions of Donald Trump's tariff tantrum. Stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Global stock markets came under pressure after President Donald Trump signed off on new U.S. tariffs on China, Canada, and Mexico, prompting fears of a global trade war. Global markets recovered somewhat some of their losses early on Monday, 3rd of February, after it emerged that U.S. President had agreed to delay new duties on goods from Mexico for a month, sparking hopes of a reprieve. President Trump rattled investors by vowing to proceed with the tariffs over the weekend, triggering what was quickly described as a Trump tariff tantrum in the global markets on Monday. Wall Street in New York opened sharply lower, with the Standard & Poor's 500 index falling almost 2%, before recovering after Mexico and the U.S. announced a month-long pause on duties to allow for negotiations. The Standard & Poor's 500 index finished down 0.8% of its value, and the technology-focused NASDAQ index was down 1.2% of its value. The Dow Jones Industrial Average briefly broke out of the red to trade marginally higher before closing down 0.3%. Earlier in the day in London, the Financial Times, the FTSE 100 share index, shed 1.4% from last Friday's record high before clawing back some of its losses to trade down 1%. Germany's DAX index fell by 1.5%, while France's CAC 40 was down by 1.2%. Spain's IBEX index dropped 1.2%, and Italy's FTSE MIB lost 0.7% of its value. NVIDIA, the U.S. technology company that manufactures advanced silicon chips, suffered a record plunge in its price last week after the emergence of the Chinese artificial intelligence firm DeepSeek. NVIDIA was the biggest faller on the Dow Jones, losing more than 5% of its share value. The Financial Times newspaper has also covered the same story and tells us more. Global stock markets have come under renewed pressure after U.S. President Donald Trump said he will go through with tariffs on China, Canada, and Mexico, prompting fears of a global trade war. Markets recovered somewhat some of their losses on Monday after it emerged that President Trump had agreed to delay new duties on goods from Mexico and Canada for a month. Shares in some of the biggest European carmakers slumped. Volkswagen, BMW, Porsche, Volvo, Stellantis, and the commercial vehicle maker Daimler Truck fell between 5% and 6%. The French car parts supplier Valeo slumped by 8%. President Trump announced 25% tariffs on Mexico and Canada and a 10% tariff on Chinese goods. In London, shares fell in companies across several industries. Shares in Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, which has investments in U.S. technology companies, the retailer JD Sports Fashion, and a miner Antofagasta, fell more than 4%. The British pound edged lower against the strengthened US dollar, down 0.6% at $1.23, but rose 0.5% against the euro to close at 1.20 euros. The Canadian dollar hit a 20-year low against the US dollar before recovering some of its losses. Doug Ford, the Premier of Ontario, Canada's most populous province, said he would ban US companies from provincial contracts until Donald Trump tariffs are removed. Doug Ford added, the U.S.-based businesses will now lose out on tens of billions of dollars in new revenues. They only have President Donald Trump to blame. Doug Ford added, we're going one step further. We'll be ripping up the province's contract with Elon Musk's Starlink. Ontario won't do business with people hell-bent on destroying our economy. Asian markets were the first to open up since the weekend's tariff announcement, with Japan's Nikkei index slumping 2.8% and the Hang Seng in Hong Kong 1% lower, although mainland Chinese markets remain shut for the Lunar New Year holiday until Wednesday. The sell-off also engulfed cryptocurrencies, which have rallied since Donald Trump's election in November. Bitcoin, the world's biggest cryptocurrency, hit a three-week low at $91,441 overnight and stood at $95,730, down 6.2%. One of Wall Street's biggest banks, J.P. Morgan Chase, expressed concern that the Trump administration was making conditions harder for businesses. The J.P. Morgan Chase chief economist, Bruce Kasman, said this weekend's actions challenge our underlying view that the Trump administration will strive to limit disruptive policies as it balances its desire to reduce engagement with the world with a commitment to support U.S. businesses. In short, the risk is that the policy mix is tilting, perhaps unintentionally, into a business-unfriendly stance. Richard Hunter, the head of the markets at the online investment platform Interactive Investor, said February seems likely to begin with a Trump tariff tantrum. Naeem Aslam, the chief investment officer at Zay Capital Markets, said investors were bracing for heightened uncertainty in global trade and economic stability. Naeem Aslam said these downturns are driven by investor anxiety about the broader impact of tariffs on the global economy, particularly as European economies are highly intertwined with U.S. trade policies. Kathleen Brooks, the research director at XTB, said this does not mean that Britain's economy will avoid impact of Donald Trump's tariffs, but it does mean that the United Kingdom's economy could be more resilient than elsewhere. Kathleen Brooks added, "It is too early to know exactly what impact tariffs will have on the global economy, but it is fair to say that they have a high potential for triggering inflation and weighing heavily on global growth, including the US economy itself."
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, assalamu alaikum, and a very warm welcome. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is your host, Zainab, and today we have in our studio our guest speaker, Brother Liaquat Abbas. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam, sister.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, dear listeners, Brother Liaquat is a research scholar in the House of Ulema of Qom, having a specialization in the field of psychology and also studying the religious studies. However, in this program, we invite our experts to give us advices on the Islamic upbringing topics. The answers are mostly rooted in the Holy Book of Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his family, and also the traditions from holy imams. So we have been discussing the ideal schedule for the adolescents, and we said in the schedule that start your day with the midnight prayers, not like waking up at the midnight, just waking up in the morning, somewhat like before morning prayers, and try to connect your Salat al-Layl with the morning prayers itself, and have a glass of water, detoxify your body, and also or arrange and organize your surroundings. Say positive statements to yourself. It's a beautiful day. Do exercise, and then go for a power nap if possible. If not, just start with the breakfast, and after power nap again, if you are taking a power nap, start with the breakfast, and then the school, depending on the timings of the morning prayers in your cities and also the distance to your schools. So we set to manage the schedule. And then also we talked about the day that throughout the day you're in the school and in the learning process, try to offer the Zuhr and the Asr prayers out there. If not possible, like the moment you're coming back home, as soon as you come back home, first, in the first place, recite namaz. And then you said it's a sport time, it's socializing time. And after socializing, now it's strictly the homework time. Yep. So what after the homework?
So, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So now that you have done your homework, the teens, it should be your namaz time probably. Like if considering it's your 6 p.m., which is your namaz time for Maghrib and Isha. So you're going to pray your namaz of Maghrib and Isha. And then the beautiful thing to do after these prayers is doing tawassul with the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salatu was-salam.
Right.
Connecting yourself with tawassul, maybe like with a ziyara, maybe by reciting a ziyara, like ziyarat of Ali Yasin, or ziyarat Ashura, example,
right,
or ziyarat Arba'een, or any other ziyara, or dua even, like dua tawassul as well,
right,
will help, like example. Or example, reciting a short masayib for yourself and crying upon the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salatu was-salam. Or going upon the terrace and reciting a short ziyarah of Imam Hussein,
Imam Hussein,
or even
right,
reciting the ziyarah of Sayyida Fatima al-Zahra, salamul alayha. So this should normally take like about 10 minutes. Like Maghrib and Isha prayers would normally take 10 minutes, and tawassul should normally take 10 minutes. So for a few people who want to start, they can start with like 2, 3 minutes or 5 minutes, and then they can stretch it up to 10 minutes or maybe more if they want to. And then, like reading some Islamic books is very important. Having Islamic knowledge is very important. So after Maghrib, so basically, you know, in the morning, there's a connection with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, with the Ahlul Bayt, with the religion. And because in the afternoon, the person is occupied, the teen is occupied. Again, in the evening, there's a connection.
Right.
So the energy, the spiritual energy is there for
right,
the teen.
Right.
In order to continue. So after that, of course, there's this beautiful time of dinner with family, which normally shows up from 6:30 to 7. So from 6 to 6:30, it's the religion time, basically, like namaz, tawassul, reading a book, like short, like a page of a book, maybe,
right,
or reading a few narrations of Ahlul Bayt,
right,
reading a part of the Holy Quran, at least a page of the Holy Quran, yeah.
Right. So I'll repeat here the timings that you're mentioning. You're only giving the examples. It all depends on the like your schedules, your prayer timings, and also your school timings and other timings. So let's take a short break here, and we'll be back in a while.
Give thanks to Allah for the moon and the stars. Praise Him all day for what is and what was. Take hold of your iman, don't give in to shaitan. Oh, you who believe, please give thanks to Allah. Allahu Ghafoor, Allahu Rahim, Allahu Yuhibbul سينين وخالقنا وراسقنا وهو على كل شيء قدير.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Islamic Upbringing, and Brother Liaquat is here with us in the studio, and we're discussing the ideal schedule. Well, we gave some of the examples of the timings, like from this to this time, should be doing this and this particular thing. For now, we were doing tawassul with the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Yeah.
So after tawassul, like a person, a teen can read a book, or maybe, like, of course, a part of the book, maybe a page or two from the book, reading a few narrations, reading the Holy Quran, at least a page or a few surahs, the short surahs at least, yeah? It's a very beautiful habit, even in the morning as well, like even in the morning after Dua Ahad, maybe like a short surah, like example, Surah Al-Adiyat, okay?
Yeah.
Example, Surah Al-Zalzala or
right,
Surah Al-Teen, okay? These are very short surahs.
Very small, right.
Which will take very less time.
Right.
But you know,
a few minutes.
Yeah, like if a person does it with consistency, and constantly, the person or the teen will definitely memorize them all the surahs, like
yeah,
whatever the teen is reciting on a daily basis.
Right.
Yeah? I remember, alhamdulillah, I got the opportunity to recite short surahs in the morning because I used to see my father reciting
that,
them.
Yeah.
I almost memorized half of a juz. Right. Of the Holy Quran, like the 30th juz.
Just
half of
listening.
It, yeah, just because of reciting it daily. So I used to recite Surah At-Tin on a daily basis until I have memorized it. I used to move on to another surah. So with this, like during my teenage period, this is how I have memorized like half of a juz. That was really a good experience for me in my teenage period. Yeah, so... So coming
so
back
actually,
to the schedule.
It's actually, before you go ahead with the schedule, I'd like to add something here. It said that when we know about the attributes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, we get a knowledge about him. But then still, when we know Allah is watching and he's all, you know, seeing and he has his punishment and everything, yet there's sometimes the deeds that we carry out are not always the perfect ones, are not always the good ones. So there's some difference between that. And something that's lacking is actually iman, is actually faith. And this faith increases by recitation of Quran.
Definitely.
And Imam Ali alayhi salam says that faith and deeds are like two inseparable brothers and friends. So yeah, let's go ahead with the ideal schedule.
So now that it's example, if the namaz time is at 6 o'clock, and the person has finished namaz, tawassul, and reading a part of book or the Holy Quran by 6:30. Now it's the dinner time. Of course, dinner with family is extremely important. Not dinner with television or not dinner with a
social
movie
media.
Or social media or anything. When a teen is having dinner, it is highly important that the phone is kept aside. Like really aside, it's not like checking messages for every 2 minutes. No, it should be aside, meaning
this
the
actually,
person shouldn't check phone for at least half an hour.
Right.
And
since you also have that psychological experience, we would like to add a bit psychological experience on that. When you are actually interacting with a family or having dinner with the family, and also checking the pop-ups on your phone, how disrespectful that is.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran."
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. Brother Liaquat is here with me in the studio. And we are discussing about the ideal schedule. Well, Brother Liaquat, you were saying of the dinner time is mostly one of the bad habits that all sons have. Or like even the elders have this, that they check on with these notifications or just keep on watching a movie, TV, whatever. So you said it's dinner with family, not dinner with television or with social media.
Yeah.
So like one of the clips that I was seeing from a psychologist actually said that even if you are watching something or you're even talking to someone and then your phone is aside on the side of you, it never gives them the message that they are most important to you at that particular moment. So whenever your phone is next to you, it always gives the other person the image that your phone is actually something that's more important to them.
Definitely.
Than you.
Yep. So that's the reason I told you that the teen has to keep it somewhere else,
right?
Not on the dining table. And of course, even the parents, you see, because that is the crucial time where the family is together.
Right.
And of course, from morning until evening, example, the father is working and is the bread earner. And of course, the mother is also working, cooking, sorting out the house, or even like sometimes even she's also working and she's also tired, you see. And this is a very like beautiful moment that all the family members are together.
Right.
They are seated on one table. And this time, the most important thing which should be happening and which should happen is interaction between themselves and not some other artificial thing coming in between these people, you see, which is a family. And of course, they need of a family is also there in with regards to psychology as well. When we see the need should be satisfied, the need of the family. Like right. You see, like I'm having a family, and this feeling should be satisfied. And one of the places where this feeling is satisfied is during the dinner time.
Okay? Right.
This is one of those places. Okay.
Yeah.
So now it's, of course, now that the dinner is done and, of course, the interaction happens. How was your day? How did it go? There's a bit of love. There are a bit of chuckles and, you know, there are a bit of maybe jokes and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's completely fine. And now that the dinner is done, the teen has to go back to some additional studies or project work if needed.
Yeah.
Of course, this is an exceptional case. If the teen is example in university or college and has a lot of things
research
to do, like to study. Yeah.
Project, yeah.
So the teen has to go towards that stuff. And that is from like 7 p.m. until 8 p.m. And that now it is like the night schedule. This is like the evening schedule. The afternoon schedule is done, like going in sports and stuff. And the evening schedule, namaz, dinner, and additional studies is the evening schedule. And now comes the night schedule. So
do we have things for night schedule?
Yeah, definitely.
Well?
Yeah.
All right. So this is not over.
Uh-huh.
Although we had from the midnight prayers to this dinner time. And also after dinner, the project time as well. So we also have now the night schedule. And how is the night schedule? We'll be talking about that in the upcoming episode. Thank you so much, Brother Liaquat, for being with us. Thank you, dear listeners. Until another episode, take good care. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran and Russia discuss regional and global issues here in Tehran. Araghchi reaffirms Iran's full support for the resistance, as well as unwillingness to negotiate its nuclear program while under U.S. pressure. In the Gaza Strip, more children die from harsh winter cold as a result of Israel's blockade and obstruction of aid supplies. And the U.N. Security Council approves a resolution calling for a swift end to the Ukraine war, with the U.S. and Russia hailing the move as a significant step toward peace. Hello everyone and welcome to World News. Our top story, Iran's foreign minister has once again stressed that the Islamic Republic's constant support for the axis of resistance in the region.
The Islamic Republic of Iran backs the resistance axis, has always supported the resistance in the region, and will continue to do so. So we are of the opinion that resistance groups fight for their just and lofty aspirations. That's what they're battling for, and in whatever way they want to continue with their resistance, they will have Iran's support for them.
Araghchi made the comments in a joint presser with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, here in Tehran. Two foreign ministers held discussions on different issues, including Palestine, Syria, and Lebanon. Araghchi stated the two have also discussed Iran's nuclear program, stressing that Tehran will not attend direct negotiations as long as the U.S. so-called maximum pressure campaign against the country is in place. The Russian foreign minister, for his part, called the talks constructive, emphasizing bilateral cooperation in all fields. Iran's Navy has conducted a joint military drill with IRGC's Aerospace Force along the southern Makran shores, the Sea of Oman, and the northern Indian Ocean. Army spokesperson Brigadier General Adidas Sheikh says the Navy's missile launchers and those of the IRGC in a first-time coordinated move hit a simulated enemy target. Operations manifest Iran's capability to respond to any threat with authority and synergy. Army maneuvers kicked off Saturday when new military hardware were put to test. The maneuvers, dubbed Zulfaqar, showcases Iran's latest defense capabilities, entailing various intelligence and security operations. Iran's Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf says the presence of massive crowds at the funeral of Hezbollah's martyred leaders was a testament to the resistance movement's unbreakable popular support. Ghalibaf praised the power and unity of Hezbollah, stressing the resistance commitment to Lebanon's security made it impossible for the enemies to eliminate the movement from the country's political or security landscape. Highlighting Hezbollah's defense against Israel's aggression, he noted the movement's role in maintaining Lebanon's sovereignty. Over the past 2 days, there were funerals and burials for Nasrallah and another Hezbollah leader, Sayed Hashem Safieddin, in Lebanon. The two were assassinated by Israel in separate airstrikes months ago. The humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza is worsening as Israel's blockade on shelter and heating supplies makes survival impossible for millions of displaced Palestinians. Severe winter cold has claimed the lives of six newborns, highlighting the devastating impact of the ongoing siege. According to medical sources, three infants have died due to freezing temperatures, and three others remain in critical condition. Hamas has condemned this as a direct result of Israel's criminal policies, accusing the occupation army of deliberately worsening civilian suffering. The resistance movement urged mediators to act immediately to stop Israel's violations of the ceasefire